You're listening to an ABC local radio podcast from Overnights. I'm Sally Knight.
And our guest this morning is Mark Pesci. He's participated in some of the most significant technological innovations over the past 30 years, including virtual reality, the World Wide Web, social media, and the Internet of Things. And he's joining us this morning. He's a futurist, inventor, author, educator, and broadcaster. And he was at the very first international conference of the World Wide Web 20 years ago. And he's joining us this morning.
Good morning, Mark.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Now, the World Wide Web, It is a very complex thing. I don't really refer to it as the World Wide Web anymore. You just caught me out saying it's the Internet. But the Internet and the World Wide Web aren't really the same thing, are they?
They're not. You can think of the Internet as the dial tone, and the web is the conversation that you're having. You need the dial tone to have the conversation, but the dial tone is separate from the conversation. So the web sits on top of the Internet. But most people had their first experience of the Internet at the same time they had their first experience of the web. And so for most people, it's identical.
Now, you were at the first international conference on the World Wide Web. The anniversary was a few weeks ago. What exactly was this conference all about?
So in about 5 years before that, so in 1989, this very bright fellow named Tim Berners-Lee was doing some work at CERN, so the big atom smasher they have in Geneva. And he had a big problem because they have lots and lots of computers there in 89. And they actually, even in 89, had the computers connected together. But although the computers were connected together, they couldn't really talk to one another. So there was files that were on one machine and data on another machine, and it was all just a kind of mishmash. And it was really hard for the physicists to actually get the results from one to another or read someone's report that's on one machine. And so Tim came up with this idea of a very simple way that all these machines could actually share their data in what he called a web. And so he did this work in 89 and then basically proceeded to spruik it for the next couple of years and got his bosses to get them to give the work away so that anyone could pick up the work and use it. And so this idea of the web as a technology started to catch on in academic circles and in a few commercial companies. And around the end of 1993, early 1994, it was clear that it was really starting to become a thing. And he decided he was going to organize a conference and get the folks who were really the thought leaders, the people who were doing the most work, into a room together so they could really start to hash out what this was going to be. You know, we had the basic idea of the web. Okay, let's talk about the things that we can do with it. Let's form working groups to solve some of the technical problems, all of that stuff. And so that event actually happened in May 25th to 27th of 1994 at CERN in Geneva.
And so you were there.
I was there.
What was it like? Did you recognize any other people who were at the conference?
I met people who I'm still friends with today, but I arrived not knowing anyone. Now, I had gotten an invitation because at the end of 93, I'd taken the work that I was doing in virtual reality and glued it to the work that Tim Berners-Lee had done on the web to create 3D on the web. And that was so we were the first people to do it. And he was quite interested in this. And I sent him a mail and said, we've done this. You've talked about how you wanted it. And he invited me to present our work at this conference. So I'm at this conference with all these other academics and people who have been working on the web for a few years, which is really all anyone had at that point. And it was at that conference that I forged friendships that I still have today. But I think most of these people did not know one another. We were all coming from all around the world. We'd all been a little sort of maybe an outlier in our own institutions working on this thing that was still really obscure and a little weird. But it was when you got us all together in the room that we realized that this was actually a project that we were all an important part of.
And so what impacts did the conference have on the internet as we know it today? Do you know what was nutted out? What was talked about? What was discussed?
Well, so Tim Berners-Lee had organized the conference and he did something very clever. The very first thing. He goes to the podium. He welcomes all of us. And we had a good laugh because that auditorium at CERN, and if you've watched the news, you've actually seen that auditorium, because when they make the announcement about the Higgs boson or whatever, those very important announcements they made in the last couple of years, they made it in that auditorium. That auditorium exists. It holds about 350 people, and that's how he capped the registrations. And one of the first things he says when he walks to the microphone, he says, "I'd like to thank all 400 of you for being here today." So the registrations had closed, and the web was getting so hot, people just flew to Geneva and crashed the conference. And they were all sort of hanging out at the top level of the auditorium. They were standing because there was no seats for them. And there was this real palpable excitement in the air that this is going to be a really important thing. And he welcomes the 400 people, sort of nodding to the gate crashers, and then says, "I'd like you to listen to Dr. David Chaum." And Dr. David Chaum came to the podium and gave his talk about this thing that he'd invented called DigiCash. DigiCash was this cash that you could use for transactions on the web. And you have to understand, the web barely existed at this point. No one was using the web for trading at this point. And he's already worked out this currency that's completely separate from dollars or pounds or euros or anything else that people are going to be using. And he talks about it and then finishes off by giving us a full demonstration running live on the web, which barely exists at this point. Here's how we're going to work it. And all of a sudden, Tim's taken this room full of researchers who are really sort of interested in maybe archiving or making pages have the right text format and all that stuff. And he's blown our minds because he's shown us that actually what we're doing is much bigger than just sharing data. It's actually about transforming the entire world and transforming commerce. And so what he's sort of hinted at is actually this project now will involve everyone everywhere in the world, and we're on the ground floor.
DigiCash, 1994, and now you've got Bitcoin and all sorts of currencies.
Right.
That was huge.
And the thing is that DigiCash didn't really take off in 1994 because the rest of the world was like, huh? I mean, the rest of the world wasn't even aware of the web in 1994. It wasn't until 95 and 96 that most people had heard of and would have their first experience of the web. And so DigiCash came out and just didn't so much fail. It just didn't have any platform to be taken up. It was too early.
Too few users. And
it didn't have anything to buy. There weren't any commercial sites until 95, 96, when you started to get Amazon and these other large commercial organizations that are web-based to trade with. And you wouldn't get something like PayPal until a few years after that. And so all of this stuff was maybe way too early. And now, 20 years later, because we do have this idea that we want to have a currency that we can use anywhere and we can use it anonymously and we want it to be secure, you have this idea of Bitcoin that maybe people have heard of over the last couple of years, this anonymous digital currency that's separate from dollars and pounds and euros or anything like that. And it's doing exactly the same thing 20 years later that we were shown on the first day of that web conference.
We're speaking with Mark Pesce this morning. He is an inventor, a futurist, an author, and an educator. And he's talking about the 20th anniversary of the first international conference of the World Wide Web. He was there in Geneva 20 years ago. Mark, what do you think the web, the World Wide Web, would have looked like if that conference didn't happen? Would it have still gone ahead?
It would have still gone ahead. I think the cohesion of the idea of a web is probably the thing that formed around that. In other words, there was a sense when you get all the people together, they start to think of themselves as a community and as the project, as a common project. So maybe before you'd have someone in a university doing a little stuff and someone over in a corporation doing a little stuff. But they'd be little projects, right? And they'd be important in those organizations, but there'd be no sense that it would actually connect to this other organization and do this. And so what you really get is this ability to be able to see the forest, not just the trees. And so this idea that there's a web is, I think, probably the thing that's born at this event, that it's not just this piece of software that's connecting computers together, but there's this idea that there's a global information network. And the interesting thing is that that's the thing that no one said at the event. No one actually said, oh my God, this is it. This is the global information system that people have been predicting for almost a century, because no one needed to say it because it was absolutely clear to everyone there. But it really wasn't until everyone was in the room together that you could believe it without maybe thinking you were slightly crazy.
And you're mentioning words like network and web and connection and sharing, which is what the web is all about. How do you think, you know, let's jump forward 20 years. How far has it actually come in that 20 years?
So I walked into this building a half an hour ago and walked up to the commissioner's desk, which is in the lobby at ABC Ultimo. And he looked up and said, do you know who's winning the soccer game? And I pulled out my smartphone and I went to the search bar and typed in Italy, Costa Rica, and it immediately came up with the final score of the match, which if no one knows out there, Italy just got knocked out of the World Cup by Costa Rica.
Ooh.
And so we're now in this world where this is real time. You know, that information is a few minutes old at best, because and it's in the palm of my hand. And it's not just in the palm of my hand. There are getting close to 2 billion smartphones in the world right now. So it's also in the palm of 2 billion other hands. This instant, ubiquitous access to whatever information, however important or however trivial, certainly if you're in Italy or Costa Rica, that's very important information.
Instant information in
brief or in depth. And that this information isn't coming from any one central source or repository. It's being generated by billions of people all of the time. And that we're all just swimming inside of this sea of information. I look at the best example I can think of when sharing's been put to good use is Wikipedia. So Wikipedia in English is 4.2 million articles. And so you can pretty much pick up any subject that you can think of, and there will be a Wikipedia article that will help you understand it better than you did before. Or if you understand it better than Wikipedia does, you hit the edit button and you add in what you know that Wikipedia doesn't, and then everyone else knows it.
It's shared knowledge.
It's shared.
And it's like an encyclopedia, you know.
It's shared knowledge, and it's an encyclopedia, and shared it not in the sense that you have to go to the library and read it, but once I've hit that button and added that bit in it, everyone in the world has it instantly. And that's like, I mean, you hear my voice rising because that's actually really incredible. You know, everyone, anything that's in my head that is specialized, something that I know that maybe not many other people know, if I can put it on a web page, whether it's in Wikipedia or somewhere else, all of a sudden, everyone else gets to know that. So now we've gone from a world in 1994 where we were basically walking around with the contents of our own heads to now we're walking around in a world with the contents of billions of people's heads. Now that's got pros and cons, but it's definitely a different world.
Definitely a different world to 20 years ago. Too much information? You just said pros and cons. There is a wealth of information at our fingertips. So many different web connections and over 2 billion smartphones, a lot of people sharing information, connecting to each other. Mm. What do you think? Too much?
I definitely don't think too much. I think that we are learning how to filter. We're also learning how the systems we use filter. Google's filters for us. Any search engine you use filters based on the things you've searched for in the past and the things it thinks you're going to be searching for in the future. And that shapes our view of the world because there is so much out there now that if we didn't have filters, it would overwhelm us all the time and the web would not be useful, right? It's funny because I will tell you a little story. In October of 1993, I actually got set up with everything at home to surf the web. And I was working a job. I was actually working at Apple at the time. And I'd come home from my job at Apple and I'd go online. And back then, you know, you dial up with a modem and everything. And
with the
all those noises, exactly. Yeah. And I'd go on the web and there was a master site of all of the websites. Because you could basically fit them all on one page. And over the course of the week, I surfed the entire web.
Wow.
Because it was like 150 websites in 1993, in October 1993, right? And they kept on adding new ones. And until about February of 1994, I could sort of stay current. And then...
What were some of these sites?
Oh,
Are any of them still around?
Some of them were. Yeah, well, CERN was one of the sites. The Digital Equipment Corporation, which is now a subsidiary of HP, you know. IBM had a website. The Vatican Library had a website.
Really?
Very early on.
On top of it.
Yeah. They were on top of it. I'm trying to remember
Any weird ones?
The Anders Magic Page. And I think if you Google Anders Magic Page, that's still up. That was a weird one. That was all sort of mysticism stuff.
Any sort of independent, smaller web coders or designers, you know, doing that sort of thing at that particular that come later?
No, Anders Magic Page was guy in Sweden, right? Just doing this page with all this mystical stuff, and he was into transhumanism and blah, blah, blah. You know, just a whole bunch of interesting sort of sci-fi, stuff. And so there was some of that, and then there was just a lot of, you know, folks who had a working group inside of a library at a university, or perhaps a documentation group inside of a corporation, and they were using it to share that stuff. So it was a real hodgepodge of just people trying little different things. And there are actually a couple of interesting little art projects that were going on at the time, too. So people would put up galleries of pictures or whatever it might be. So it was just a sort of snapshot, not everything, but just stuff. And I made a practice of going in every day and checking the next couple of websites that were going up. But by February, it had started to explode, and it was just impossible. And after that, the web was just too big. And then it really did become important to use, for instance, I think it was called Dave and Jerry's World Wide Web Index, which was later renamed Yahoo.
Okay, one of the first search engines to sort of filter through all the content and filter through all of the amazingness of the World Wide Web.
And before it was a search engine, it was almost a library with different categories. And so you could actually go into any category and find the websites that would be about that category and then go directly to them. So that was even before people thought about having a search engine, which actually didn't really come along until 95, when that list of categories got too big to deal with. Too many categories, too many websites. Oh, wait, we have to start searching. And then you start to get that idea of a search engine. Today, you can't think of using the web without using a search engine because it's too big.
You type in something to any particular search engine, and it's sort of like, in 1.3 seconds, there's about 10 billion pages that is offering you all sorts of information. Yeah. There's so much at your fingertips.
Yeah.
And at this point, back in 1994, how fast were things working? What was the design like?
I mean, the thing is that web pages in 1994 were very, very simple. They were text. And there were maybe some images, and maybe there were a few buttons that were square, right? Nothing pretty about any of this. And so by modern standards, those pages loaded very fast. It was all very fast, even if you were over a modem link, because there just wasn't a lot going back and forth. Text doesn't take a long time to send over a modem. So in that sense, it felt quite snappy. But it wasn't rich like the way we have it today with, you know, half a dozen images and beautiful things and animations flowing by. Because part of what we've learned over the last 20 years is an entire visual language for the web that, you know, and it varies from site to site, but there are elements in common. And so people sort of learn, oh, that's a button. I know I'm going to do that. Oh, that's a video. I know what to do if I click on that, and so on and so forth.
We've taught ourselves.
We've all learned together.
And we're still learning.
And we're still learning.
We're speaking with Mark Pesci this morning. He was at the 20th, well, he was at the original, the very first international conference of the World Wide Web 20 years ago in Geneva. He's a futurist, an inventor, an author, educator, and broadcaster, and we're talking to him this morning about the World Wide Web. And if you want to get in touch, if you perhaps remember the first time you used the web the first time you used the internet, you can remember and want to tell us what it was like, we'd love to hear from you. The number is 1-300-800-222. We do have a caller, Brett, who has a question for you, Mark. Hi, Brett.
Okay. Have you ever looked up the website www something.com.
Oh, I think I probably have, but not for many, many, many years. I'm pretty sure that's an old one because that's ringing a bell somewhere. What does it do?
It just has the word something.
Exactly.
And a whole blank page.
Exactly.
Well, I think that probably at the time, because www.something.com probably does go back a long way. I think that it probably looked like a very funny joke at the time. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a joke that we've seen a lot since then, so it's not that funny anymore. But I think at the time it was probably really funny. Mm. And one of the things is we toss URLs around in our language now, right? You don't need, it's like, oh, what's the URL for that, right? We don't even know. Most people don't know what URL means. They know that it means it's a link on the web, but they don't know what the letters stand for. And yet that's entered our language as, you know, as much as we want to share links. And so we'll say, oh, yeah, it's at something.com or you know, whatever it might be, nothing.com. And so even over the last 20 years, our language and the way we talk to one another has actually incorporated the web at this fundamental level, that we're sharing links just by talking. We have so many different ways to connect because of the web. And because of the internet, and because of smartphones, and because of all the other devices, that it has really changed the quality of human communication in some interesting ways. And we aren't really, we're still learning, let's put it that way. You know, we know that we can use these devices to hide behind, and we can also use them to connect with. And
have two opposite effects.
Most of the time, I think we're sort of wrestling. We're almost balanced between those two.
For example, Mark, I might never, ever have to leave my house ever again. I can socialize through any sort of social media platform, get in touch with friends or ex-friends, whatever. I can order my shopping online. Mm. I can buy clothes online. I can, you know, even do online dating if I'd like to meet someone special. I may not even have to leave the house anymore.
Mm. It's interesting because if you think about, I don't know if you saw the film Her, many people did, but the setup for the movie, the first half hour of the movie sort of shows what that's like, right? Where everything sort of is at a remove. And I think in some ways that film is very clever because it showed a mirror to, you know, it's an amplified mirror, but it's a mirror to what the present moment looks like. And that if we really wanted to, we could flee from the human touch in a way that we really couldn't before. And there's a temptation there. And one of my favorite writers and thinkers in this area is an amazing woman, Dr. Sherry Turkle. And she's been studying how children use computers for 30 years. So really, as long as there have been computers, she's been studying how children use them and how has followed these people as they grow up. And she's realized that as amazing as these devices can be to help us be expressive, you know, that we can use them to project into them different facets of ourselves that we wouldn't necessarily reveal in public, she's also seen that we can use them to hide behind and that they can become a way of barricading ourselves from the world as much as they are a way of encountering the world.
Becoming reclusive and hiding behind the World Wide Web and the internet.
Because it can be a place where you don't allow yourself to be hurt by other people. You know, and you have to be connected to be hurt. And so if you don't allow yourself to be connected, you're safe, but you're also not an adult.
We're speaking with Mark Pesci this morning on ABC Overnights. And there's also the counter argument to that. The sharing, the so much oversharing. What do you think about that aspect? I mean, looking at how far the World Wide Web has gone in 20 years.
Listen, humans have always overshared. It's just that when we overshared, it didn't reach a couple billion people before. Now when we overshare, it reaches a couple of billion people. But oversharing is not a new human phenomenon. People have been gossiping since we learned how to speak. So it's not so much that we overshare, it's that we're coming into understanding what oversharing means when everyone in the world gets to find out how you looked when you had a bad moment at that party last night, or, you know, someone photographed you when you were at the cricket match when you actually pulled a sickie at work, or, you know, it's all of those moments now that we're still struggling to come to terms with. But I don't think oversharing per se is new. It's the fact that oversharing goes everywhere.
We do have a few callers. Let's go to Alison. Hi, Alison.
Hi there. How's everyone going?
Yeah, good. Thank you for calling. What did you want to say to Mark?
I just wanted to thank Mark. I can't explain how much I use the internet or the net, because I trained as a librarian back in the 1970s.
Mm.
So I've always been passionate about information, and I can't believe, the thing I can't believe is it's only 20 years.
Mm.
I really find that hard to believe. So I really just wanted to thank you, because I have a pad in my car where if I'm listening to the radio, I jot down things that I want to look up.
Mm.
I'm constantly looking up information, because I love information. So I just wanted to thank you so much.
No. Yeah. Thank you very much, Alison. That's wonderful.
One of the things that was a persistent theme at the first international conference was the idea of recreating the Library of Alexandria. Now, for the folks at home who may not know, the Library of Alexandria was the greatest library of the ancient world. And it got burned multiple times, at least once by Julius Caesar. But it got burned. And I think the last time it got burned badly enough that there are texts. So the Library of Alexandria was reputed to have a copy of every scroll book that had been written in the known world. So all of Europe and you know, the Middle East and Africa to that point in time. And people would flock to Alexandria. It was the great center of learning in the ancient world. And if you were a scholar, you would go and study there because all of the books were there. So it'd be the equivalent roughly of the Library of Congress, say, or the National Library of Australia, something like that. And there are a lot of books that we don't have from the ancient world because we've lost copies of them. We know they exist because they're referred to. There's a lot of Aristotle, for example. Plato, but they don't exist because we don't have copies in the modern world. And there was this sense that the web was going to be that for the modern world, that it was going to be the library, capital L, and that we were going to, in a sense, create the library. And we actually managed to do that really quickly, you know, sort of by 96 or 97. That was pretty much, we could tick that box off. Yeah, we'd done that. We provided, and then it became all of these other things. But I think at the core, the first real champions for the web outside of this tight community of academics were the librarians, because they had wanted this. And once they saw it, they got right behind it.
I know back at school we used to have obviously the library, you know, your bibliography, you'd have to go in and type what sort of books you wanted to look up. And then when the first computers came in, it was, you know, Encarta, the encyclopedia, and you could kind of jump onto the computers and search these things. But once the internet came in, it completely changed everything. The way we did our schoolwork, our assignments, our research, and then onto university, a whole other ball game as well.
Yeah.
We have a few more callers on the line. Let's go to George. Hi, George.
G'day, Sally. How are you?
I'm well. I'm well. Mark's with us this morning. You've got a question for him?
Yeah, well, a question and a comment. Firstly, it's quite fascinating about talking about your idea about people not having to leave their house. I remember actually reading or studying a short story, or actually might have been an excerpt from a novel called When the Machine Stops. Oh, this would have been in the 70s, where it was about people who were literally living in their own cubicles and being kind of fed everything they needed. Of course, the only problem was when the machine that ran everything stopped, they were totally helpless. It's a bit like that movie Wall-E, if you remember that animated film with the people living up in the spaceships who, you know, didn't even know how to walk anymore.
It is an interesting concept. It is.
Well, yeah. It's actually,
and it's a possibility.
Well, it actually seems some of that happening now, because I think there's a recent study just the other day that apparently said in a study of these young kids who'd grown up digital natives with the web, 30% of them needed speech remediation therapy because they had trouble actually making the sounds that in everyday language, because of the fact that their parents would actually just give them an iPad or, or what have you to play with, and they didn't actually communicate enough to actually develop their speaking skills, and they actually needed remedial therapy.
Yeah, thanks, George. What do you think about that, Mark?
So first off, the story is called The Machine Stops. It's by E.M. Forster, and it was written in the 1920s. That's the amazing thing about it. So E.M. Forster, you know, wrote A Room with a View, Howard's End, all of these amazing Merchant Ivory films later on. And it's a brilliant story, and you can find it online. I advise everyone to go and read it because it's a very chilling view of the future. I do get very distressed when I see a device being used as a dummy, essentially, because I do think that, particularly in very young children, they actually need as much embodied experience as possible because they are learning to mediate themselves in the real world. They're learning how to work in the real world. And the more experience they have in the real world, the better equipped they will be when you hand them a device. I'm not saying you shouldn't give them devices at all. I think you do. But I think you have to be very careful about how you meter it out because, and I wrote a book about this 15 years ago, which is that children are now getting devices that are qualitatively unlike the devices that we had. When I was a kid, I had Legos were the new shiny toy when I was a kid. And, you know, oh, my God, you know, Legos and Matchbox cars. And now you give someone this device that's deeply interactive and it changes the way they think. It gives them a different platform for their experience to project into. That's good. But you don't want to sacrifice the experience of the real world as well. You have to build with both pillars. You can't build with just one or just the other, not in this world.
You can't build Lego with a flat screen either, you know?
Well, but you can build Minecraft, which is what kids are doing now. But what I'll normally see is kids have both Lego and Minecraft. They have the real world and they have the virtual world.
Yeah, very good. Thank you for your call, George. Let's go now to Virginia. Hi, Virginia. How are you?
I am really well. I'm so excited to talk to you. I've got in front of me a sheet of paper that was printed off on the 29th of November, 93. And my son was 20 then, and he'd had computers and a modem for quite a while by then. And it's from the Science Space Station from the Kennedy Space Center. It's about the shuttle stuff and about all the names that were used for the shuttles.
So would this have been an email or a fax?
No.
Or
What was Mark calling them? Were you calling them text at that stage in the 29th of November, 93?
No, that probably NASA would have had a website in 1993 because NASA would have been very early on this. So that could very well have come off of a very early version of a NASA website.
Well, I've got the website here. It's at titan.ksc.nasa.gov. So isn't that fantastic?
Well, very good.
That could be Usenet. There were things that preceded the web, and it's interesting here because there were a couple of technologies that could have ended up being the web that didn't, in part because they were either too hard for people to use or they were commercial. So there was one very popular one called Gopher that a lot of researchers were using that came out of the University of Minnesota, and then the regents of the university decided that they were going to start charging people to set up Gopher servers. And the researchers said, okay, well, we can either pay for Gopher or we can use the web because the web is free because that was the way CERN had wanted it. And you could see a real migration away from the thing that costs money to the thing that was free. I think not just because people wanted to save money, although I think a lot of this was academic work and they didn't have a lot of money to spend. But I think they also saw the openness and the sharing around it as being more important.
Thank you very much for that call, Virginia. We are speaking with Mark Pesci this morning. He was at the International Conference of the first International Conference of the World Wide Web 20 years ago in Geneva. And he has participated in some of the most significant technological innovations, sort of virtual reality in the World Wide Web, social media, and he's a futurist and inventor as well. He joins us this morning to talk about the internet and the World Wide Web. I want to talk a little bit about what we can expect in the future, but a few messages I'd like to read out to you first, Mark. From Ricky, this is giving me chills. He says, I started my computer science degree in 1993 and used Lynx on a VAX VMS machine. became one of the first 20 bloggers ever, quite by accident. Mm-hmm. A little bit later down the track in the 90s. Mm. Ricky, I've got no idea what Lynx or Vax or VMS machines are, but I'm sure Mark does.
Yeah, well, Ricky, I still do occasionally use Lynx. So Lynx is a web browser, but it runs in a terminal. And most people will have not seen a terminal. So it's sort of the old style of text where you type and the commands are all on a command line. And that tends to be something that's reserved for computer boffins these days.
Like the black and green screen.
Black and green screen. Yeah. And you can actually put a web browser on that. You don't need a mouse and all of that fancy stuff. And Lynx is a great way of doing it. And if you're trying to do something really quickly, down and dirty, and you don't need the pretty stuff, Lynx is a great way to do it. Mm. But it's been around for a really long time, and it worked very, very well. So I can appreciate that. And Vax and VMS, those are computers that don't really exist anymore, but were very common, particularly in universities back at that period of time.
Are they making it simpler? Well, is it becoming easier, do you think?
To use the web?
Mm.
Yeah, I think that there's a big push on. So you talk about what's going to be happening in 20 years. The big thing that's going to happen sort of over the next 5 years is the number of smartphones in the world is going to grow from, there's a little bit less than 2 billion today. And in 5 years' time, so before the decade ends, 6 billion smartphones. All right, now there's somewhere around 5.5 billion mobile subscriptions, but a lot of people have more than one. There's something between 3.5 and 4 billion people who have mobiles right now. So somewhere over half the planet is carrying a mobile around with them. And pretty much by the end of this decade, almost all of those people are going to be carrying smartphones around with them, which means that, you know, you can have a farmer in India who will have a smartphone and will have access to the same quality and depth of information that anyone in Australia does. And that's going to be incredible because now all of a sudden all sorts of learning resources that were completely out of reach for them are going to be in the palm of their hand. It could be handed to a son or a daughter to help them in their education and will simply be part of their lives now. So in a sense, the real promise of the web to bring knowledge to everyone, well, it's brought knowledge to people who already had it, brought it to us. We already had plenty of knowledge. And now it's about to bring it to people who actually haven't had it before.
That's awesome. It's wonderful to think about how far the internet and the World Wide Web has come in the past 20 years and what will happen in the future. We have a couple more calls. David, how are you this morning?
Yeah, good evening. Good morning to both you and Mark. Mark, I heard of a guy in America, a young guy. He invented this system that, you know, when they use a search engine and they go, you know, for a certain subject, it goes to the most popular site. Mm. He worked out a system where you bypass that popular site and you go to a site 1,000 times or 10,000 times removed from the most popular website when you're searching on your search engine. Have you heard of that guy that invented that system?
I haven't, but I can see that that would be actually interesting because quite often people aren't looking for the top hit on a search engine. You know, you actually sometimes will find things by accident. And this is one of the things that is getting harder to do. The more search engine tools you use, the harder it is to sort of stumble on things. The way we stumble on things now is because a friend will share something with us. But if you want to stumble on things, then you don't want to go to the top hit because that's the thing that's probably going to confirm your expectations. You actually want to subvert that a little bit, you know. And in a sense, that's a search engine that's almost a bit like a larrikin. It's going to try to sort of mix things up.
All right. Mm. Just quickly, with imagination and everything, I like that word objective chance. You know, when you just come across things out of, you're looking for something and then you go to somewhere else after that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely know what you mean. Thanks very much for the call,
Thank
David.
Thank you.
On the line, we also have Charles. And Charles, how are you?
Hello, Sally. Hello, Mark.
Hi there.
I'm interested to know why there was such a delay between having all of the ducks in a row and the conference in CERN. The reason is that Doug Engelbart in 1963 invented the mouse.
Yes.
In 1968, December, there was the mother of all demos.
Yes.
Very quickly, that covered images, audio, mouse interface, graphics, and video.
Yes. Yes.
And Ted Nelson developed hypertext in 1963.
So why did it take so long for the conference to actually get themselves together and get rocking along?
There are 1,000 computer professionals at the 1968 fall conference.
Mm.
Why the next 20 years did it all go silent?
Right. All right. Thanks very much, Charles. What do you think, Mark?
Okay, so I should expand a little bit. Douglas Engelbart, who passed away last year, created a system called the NLS. And it was demonstrated at this event in December of 1968. And it's called the Mother of All Demos. If you type Mother of All Demos into Google, there's video of it. And you can see the whole thing.
Mm.
And he invents hypertext and the mouse. I mean, he invents all of modern computing during this talk. I'm not making this up. And, you know, I always crack the joke that he invented it all in 1968, and basically what we did in the next 20 years was fill in the details, which is kind of why it went silent, because he was so far ahead. What he showed was so beyond. In 1968, most computers were confined to what they call batch processing, where you would type up your program on a series of punched cards, which probably a lot of people in the audience don't even remember. You would hand them to someone at the data processing center, and you would return the next day for the output of your program to find out if it worked or if you had to fix it. And this was computing in 1968 for almost everyone in that room. And all of a sudden, this guy comes in, and he's got stuff going that really won't really be going for 30 more years. So it's as if someone beams in from another planet. So, Charles, the reason it took that long is because he was so far ahead. What he did was he established the vision. And then essentially, computer science, as it developed, fulfilled everything that he demonstrated in that talk. Now, that said, he did this talk. 1968, the internet didn't launch until August of 69. So he did this talk before there was an internet, and he was still showing networks and everything like this. So the technology had to catch up, but not just the technology, the way all of the people who were computer professionals and the way businesses were using computers, all of that had to catch up too. And that takes time. You know, most of what we do on the web in 2014, we could have done in 1994, but you don't know what you don't know. It takes 20 years of us using the web and learning how to use it and improving that and then sharing what we've learned to get to the web of 2014, which is so much more useful because what we've essentially learned is how to share.
And you mentioned that a lot more people will have access to the internet in the future. Mm. But how will we be using it? Do you know what I mean?
Well, the web is, in a sense, going to be in our palms, but it's also going to embed itself all around the world. So we have this thing called the Internet of Things, which is basically that everything that either has a battery or plugs into mains power is going to be smart and going to be communicating, sometimes with you, sometimes with one another. The analogy I like to use is Downton Abbey. You've got the servants downstairs and you've got the master and the family upstairs. And the servants downstairs are all communicating with each other to make the environment as nice as possible for the master and the family. So later on this year, it's expected that Apple is going to be selling a smart wristwatch. And it's probably going to be the case that within a few years, you'll be able to wander around your house wearing this wristwatch. And that wristwatch will state which room you're in so that the lighting can adjust to the room you're in, so that the temperature can adjust to your favorite temperature. And all of this is going to happen behind the scenes. You're not going to have to do anything about this. It's just going to be that way. And in 10 years after that, we will have a vague memory of the fact that when we walked into a room, we had to do something about the lighting and the heating, but it will be sort of ancient history. And it's because the web is going to connect all of these devices, not just to us, but to one another.
Everything will be connected.
Everything.
Now that we've learned to share, the devices will be learning to share and interact, and different brands and different products will be doing the same thing.
Exactly.
It's kind of scary. Exciting. Is that what you're most excited about?
Well,
the possibilities.
It's certainly one of them. I do think that there's an enormous capacity now. We're actually starting to see computers get smart, and I'm going to use that sort of in quotes, but I spent a lot of time doing some research around a project called Watson. Watson is a computer that IBM has trained up, and it beat a bunch of the world's best players of the Jeopardy quiz game a couple of years ago, which was no mean feat for a computer to do, because Jeopardy's a hard game for people because of the way the questions work.
Yeah.
But then after that, they sent it to medical school, and it's now maybe the best clinical oncologist in the world.
Artificial intelligence.
Yes. So it's not like it's not like HAL 9000. It's not like a Terminator, but it is really smart. And when a doctor uses it, they can have a really well-trained oncologist guiding them in treatment. And so IBM is now out and offering it to oncologists in Australia and in America as a partner in the treatment process. So all of a sudden, all of the oncologists are going to have access to real intelligence that will help them deliver the best possible outcomes to patients.
So huge in the health world. Doing
And in call centers and all other things. But in terms of that, it also then means in a couple of years, that'll be a smartphone app. And so someone in Nigeria who only has access to a GP, but that GP has access to Watson, all of a sudden gets a quantum leap in their medical care because the way the web is carrying this intelligence.
Oh, it's so exciting. Mm. It's fantastic. We have to say thank you so much, Mark, for joining us on the program. Mark Pesci, he has been talking about the anniversary of the first international conference of the World Wide Web, which happened 20 years ago in Geneva. He was there. He's a futurist, inventor, author, educator, broadcaster, and he's been at the forefront of innovations, technological innovations over the past 30 years, looking at virtual reality and the web and social media and the Internet of Things. And he does a fantastic job. Thank you so much for your time.
It's been a pleasure.
That's it for the ABC Local Radio Overnights podcast. I'm Sally Knight. Thanks for listening.